Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast, episode number 11. Today, my conversation is with Kyle Benson. Kyle calls himself an intentional relationship coach. I actually met Kyle at an event for therapists a little over a year ago. And then fairly recently, one of my friends forwarded me one of his newsletters, not knowing that I knew him. And so I wanted to connect with him because he was talking about a lot of things that I think are super important, which we go into in this conversation. What does it mean to have a healthy, secure relationship? What does that look like? So this is one of many podcasts where I will talk about this, and I love Kyle's perspective. I also love what he brings around the concepts of shame and masculinity and how that plays out in relationship. About halfway through this episode, you may or may not hear a bit of a catastrophe. Everything expressed in the Live Your Life podcast is either my opinion or the opinion of my guest, and this is not a replacement for healthcare services. If you find yourself in need of therapy or other healthcare services, please seek out resources for that. I'm Jasmine Savari, and welcome to the Live Your Life podcast. As a coach with a master's degree in psychology, I know that so many of us are missing the authentic experience of truly living our lives. I want to inspire you with conversations that expand your consciousness and empower you to create the best life possible. Let's start living now, because now is all we have. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we have some really good stuff we're going to talk about today. So I met Kyle at a counseling event probably about a year ago, and then one of my girlfriends actually emailed me an email from his mailing list, and it really hit me, and I knew that we needed to have a conversation. So Kyle, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what you specialize in?
Yeah, so I'm a huge relationship nerd, so I nerd out on kind of the research behind kind of the relationships and how they work. And one of the things that I do in my spare time, in addition to working with clients, is I work in a love lab. And this is Dr. Gottman's love lab, where we have couples come in and we observe their conversations, and then they'll do marital therapy. And I also do research studies there. And I'm a huge fan of attachment theory. And so kind of what got me into what I'm doing is really some personal experiences. I had some really unhealthy relationships and had a really tough time with those relationships, with being cheated on and feeling lied to and feeling really, really insecure and inadequate. And ended up over time, my body kind of had a reaction where I developed this outbreak of psoriasis that like covered me from head to toe. And at that point, it really caused me to look at, like, how did I get here? And for some reason, I picked up the book Attached by Amir Levine and Rachel Heller, and then What Makes Love Last by Dr. John Gottman. And that really kind of set me off on this journey to figure out what makes love last, how it works, and also understanding attachment and how that is so vital to our intimate relationships.
Okay, you're saying so much important stuff. So going back to the psoriasis outbreak, how did you know that that was connected to psychologically and emotionally what was happening for you? Did somebody help you see that, or did you understand that and explore it?
It was an assumption. I mean, my therapist was like, this feels like a physiological response to psychological challenges. And so I was, what we know too from research is, when you're in unhealthy relationships, particularly if there's contempt and a lot of insecurity, your nervous system is going to react in this constant state of fight or flight. And so I was in that state a lot, and I was not doing a lot of good self-care. And I just felt like I was never enough. And so some of the ways I tried to cope with that was drinking, you know, not sleeping a bunch, doing a whole bunch of things that were not healthy. And I think that contributed to my physical response.
I know this is a horrible thing to just say, but sometimes in my own experience and what I'm hearing in your experience, it was so bad that you had to do something about it almost. Like you couldn't ignore it. And I think a lot of people ignore things like this that come up and they just maintain this misery in their lives because it's bearable. So sometimes it's a good thing when it comes crashing down because we can really see that something has to change. And I hear that's what happened for you. And I'm grateful because your work is super important. So I really wanted to talk to you about your understanding of masculinity and avoidance patterns. That was really what caught me when I started looking at your stuff when my friend sent it to me again a year after we met. So I know that attachment is your thing. So can you tell us, like, what's important? What should we be talking about here?
I mean, attachment theory is this, there's tons of research on it, but essentially it says that the way we connect with important others is pretty, for the most part, predictable. And so there's about four different ways we can connect with other people. And we start to learn this in our childhood, right? Is when how our parents love us, how they connect with us, how they talk with us, we start to develop what is called an internal working model, which is pretty much how we see ourselves and how we see other people, especially the people who are important to us, and how much we can depend on them, how open we can be, how close we can be to them emotionally, and how much we can rely on them. And so we kind of build this like almost like map of our intimate relationships, what we can do and what we can't do and what works and what doesn't work. And we start to carry that from our childhood into adulthood. And that is essentially the attachment theory, is that our early relationships impact our adult relationships. And they found that to be reoccurring in very similar patterns from childhood to adulthood. And just to kind of give a brief, ultimately, depending on how that happens, our childhood environment is and how we're loved, right? We develop one of four styles. The first style is very secure. This is where we feel really loved and cared for. We have a freedom of our opinions. We're able to be autonomous, but yet connected and close with other people. We develop the ability to have high self-worth, but also to look at kind of our flaws and see how we can grow and improve. We see others as good, and we're really kind of interpersonally related. Like, we really think about, oh, how do we work as a team through these issues rather than this is all about me or this is all about them. They also deal really well with difficult emotions, and even joy and intimacy. And so there's a lot more safety that their nervous systems and their brains have experienced around connection, closeness, and intimacy. And so it's easier for them. Now, if you go to a home where parents were preoccupied, were sometimes available, sometimes not available, sometimes warm and loving, sometimes hostile and critical, right? You develop more of a anxious style where you kind of start to internalize those experience and think, there must be something wrong with me. And one of the strategies you learn to cope with that kind of environment is you start to be extra clingy to your parents. You might exaggerate things to make a scene of them so you can get the attention that you want, because you feel like you have to do that to get their attention. And then that translates to adult relationships where someone is more clingy, wants to always be close to their partner, is fearful of not being good enough, fears that they're too much. And so a whole bunch of things that we're going to talk a little bit more about there. And then the third one is avoidant. And that style is where you were pretty much left to be alone. There was emotional neglect in a way where you weren't getting a lot of attention. Your emotions weren't regulated. You kind of developed this belief system that if I'm going to survive, I have to do it all by myself. And I cannot rely, depend, or trust other people. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I just want to put it out there, the attachment theory, from my understanding, is the most researched theory of psychology. I use it a lot in my practice as well. And when we tell these things to our clients, Kyle, I'm sure you have the same experience, because you're saying they're so predictable. When people start understanding their attachment styles, it really opens their eyes and describes them in a way that they have never even understood before. But it is incredibly predictable, which is why when somebody tells you specific characteristics of their relationship patterns, we can really understand them. I mean, the good news and the bad news is, like, we're not as special as we think we are. Like, we have these patterns that play out, and we can categorize them, which is helpful, I think, for the healing process.
I 100% agree. I mean, when you have new information, right, and we have these predictable patterns that we see, then we can learn what patterns we can do differently.
And we're like, the way that I like to talk about it is it puts us in the shape of a puzzle piece, and we continue to attract the same kind of thing over and over. And so we can go into it telling ourselves consciously, I want to attract something that's going to fit differently. But it's not until we change our own puzzle piece and the way that we attach to people that we're actually going to experience something different. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think that's a huge part. And I mean, you've probably had this. I've worked with people who we've been able to change that within their intimate relationships, doing couples therapy and having them attach differently and having them have completely different conversations that they've never had. They're set to express emotions. They start to listen to each other differently. They speak more directly and gentle. But then also individuals who, you know, they have been attracted to partners who won't go to couples therapy, or they have partners who aren't invested, and they kind of go through these cycles of partners who just aren't good for them. And as they start to do that inner work and develop what is called earned secure attachment, their romantic relationships start to change as well, because they start to do the healing they need.
I love this. I could nerd out on this all day too. And so I'm curious in your experience. When I talk to a lot of my clients, I like to put it out there that this is a pattern that has been deeply ingrained for most of your life. And usually we don't become aware of it until we're adults. And so changing it to set a realistic expectation, it takes time. You're not going to just read a book and suddenly show up differently. And I think there's a lot of the time of fantasy that we can understand what we need to do differently, and it's going to happen. I'm curious to hear, in your experience, when you work with couples who are learning this earned secure attachment, how long does that process take? What does that look like?
It depends. Again, so this is what's interesting. There is a spectrum of, in the research, we talk about anxiety and avoidance in these styles in a spectrum, right? And so in the middle of that is what we would call secure attachment. And so depending on if they're pretty close to that, right, a few tweaks and they're going to move pretty quick to that. The farther they go out, the longer treatment is going to take, because we're going to have to explore a lot more of that internal working model, the beliefs about the self, the beliefs about their partner, right? And it can take, I mean, you can take a year. Sometimes it takes longer than that, but you can do some pretty serious deep work trying to get them to navigate. And sometimes the sessions go really deep into some of the stuff. Sometimes it's little stuff of even just like, you know, I've realized I've been guessing this whole time about where you're at. And it's really hard for me to ask you, because I'm fearful that if I ask you what you want or need, I'm going to fail you, right? And so there's sometimes these little moments that need to be corrected and changed to more secure strategies in the moment. But then there's also the bigger underlying themes of the belief systems and the attachment strategies that, when we start to address them, can be changed. And as a result, that creates more of that earned security or that secure functioning in the relationship. Does that make sense?
Totally. And I love what you said about the one partner guessing how their partner is going to respond. And I think it's so important to highlight, so many of us in relationship are not actually in the relationship that we think we're in. We're unconsciously mm-hmm. acting out our childhood relationships and assuming that our partner is our original attachment figure, mom or dad or something like that, which is why I think it's so important to have that third party in the room, somebody who can look at you and help you process and understand, because we're all in our own perceptions of reality. And it's really hard for us to identify our own perceptions of reality without somebody helping us look at ourselves. I think it's really important.
Yeah. And I think that's spot on, right? I mean, if you come from an anxious or avoidant, you know, upbringing, right, that becomes the kind of the glasses through which you look at your adult relationship. And so your body is primed to look for those triggers, look for the cues that someone's not trustworthy or someone's not reliable. And it's sometimes what we also see is that sometimes we can misread cues and start a conflict when actually that there wasn't an issue there. And that's another thing we know about kind of particularly the anxious attachment style, is they are so hypersensitive to little, even facial features or things, and that can cause their brain to go to this alarm state. And they'll have that reaction that just can set off into a conflict for both partners.
Yeah, it's super important stuff. So I want to rewind just a little bit and say something about I really think it's interesting when you talked about the specific attachment styles. And the fourth one is the disorganized attachment, which we won't go into.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So some of the research that was done, one of the most famous research studies that we learn in school is called the Strange Situation. And I'm always fascinated to share with people the experience of the avoidant. So what happens with the avoidant, like you were talking about, they basically learn that their needs aren't going to be met. So they stop asking. And so when we look at this experiment, it's with infants showing their attachment styles. The avoidant baby didn't really need anything from mom in the experiment. And I think what happens is society sees that avoidant baby as like, what a good baby. It doesn't need anything. They don't have any needs. And I think that fast forward in our lives, like a lot of the time it's seen as a good thing if we don't need other people, if we're kind of like self-sustaining, and that's not necessarily a good thing. And so what I really want to move forward and talk about with you, and we'll talk about other things too, but this avoidant and the masculine and the concept of shame, like we kind of talked about, and how confusing and messy these relationships can be and how hard it is to understand them without judging what's really happening.
Yeah. And I think we live particularly in the United States, in Western cultures, there is this ideology that if you're independent, you're a good person, right? Yeah. America is built on kind of avoidant roots. But I think in terms of this, it's interesting, right? When we go back to that strange situation, that avoidant kid who acts like he doesn't need mom, if we were to look at his physiology, heart rate, blood pressure, other things like that, you would see so much anxiety.
Right? That's so sad. But from the outside, it looks good. And we're all taught to look at what's happening on the outside other than what's happening on the inside.
Right. And so what we know is especially as avoidance, when I'm working with them as they get older, is they're so sensitive. And that's what's, I think, so fascinating, particularly when I'm in couples therapy, is when one partner's like, I had no idea your brain was on, 24/7, guessing where I'm at, trying to figure out if I'm happy with you, if I'm not happy with you. I had no idea you always thought about this, right? And so part of the avoidant strategy is there's not a lot of cues they give off of what's going on inside, right? And that is a very protective strategy, right? If I'm anxious and you don't know that, well, you're going to leave me alone, right? And so in a way, it's this almost unconscious strategy that's protective in nature. But unfortunately, when it comes to intimate relationships, right, it causes us to be really distant from people. We don't share. We don't take emotional risk. And we kind of feel really isolated and lonely. But what's super interesting in avoidant culture, or in avoidance and masculinity, is if we talk about masculinity, right, my upbringing was, as to be a man, you must be independent. You must not show any emotion unless it's anger. And you must figure out things by yourself, right? Don't rely on other people. If you don't, you're a sissy, you're weak, blah, 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 whatever these horrific false beliefs are that were pushed onto us. And that's what we see in the avoidance style. They don't acknowledge their difficult emotions. They kind of minimize their vulnerabilities. And they're like compulsively self-reliant. And they do not share difficulties with other people. And so it makes it really hard to rely or depend on someone when you have learned and have this deep core belief that other people are untrustworthy, are not reliable, and that you cannot depend on them.
I want to jump in and interrupt you too for a second here, because what you're talking about is so important and it is everywhere. And I think for a lot of years, I think we understand that this happens. But the more that I dive into this work, I'm reading a book right now that I'm loving. It's Terrence Real, called I Don't Want to Talk About It. And when we talk about how little boys are taught to have their emotions, I mean, we kind of understand they're different than women, females, right? Male and female experience is different. But going back to the very beginning, like what was happening on the cartoons and TV shows that we were watching when we were little? We may think that our parents were really supportive. That's the other thing I want to jump back to. You were talking about the secure relationship. where the children felt loved and cared for by their parents. And I love to talk about, it's not about blaming mom and dad. It's not about making them look bad. That's not the intention of therapy. It's looking at what was the reality. You could still feel loved and cared for, but they could have still created a dynamic where you developed an anxious or avoidant attachment style, right? And so, you know, you could have grown up in a family where you felt like you weren't necessarily taught these gender differences, or, you know, it wasn't a really big deal, or you were allowed to have your emotions, but it comes from everywhere. What were the TV shows? What did they show us about what it meant to be a superhero? What kind of looks did little boys get if they, you know, wanted to play with a doll, or if they cried, like if they were playing sports? What did they learn? Like, this is, it is so ingrained in our perceptions of reality that I think we expect ourselves to understand it or move through it quickly. But I want to point out, like, this stuff is, we don't even see it. It is everything that we understand about the world. And for men to expect them to be quote unquote emotionally available is a lot more difficult than just a surface level expectation or request.
Yeah, and that's 100%. And I think, you know, there's research that shows by 18 months, boys are treated differently than girls. Right.
Totally.
There is these ingrained messages within our culture on how a boy should be, how a girl should be, the clothes, the toys, right? There's a segregation, and there's not a lot of freedom or exploration. And parents kind of take it upon themselves to, you know, push their kids one direction or another. And what's interesting is they do that because that's what their parents did to them. Right. And so we have these multi-generational patterns that get pushed from one generation to the next that live in our bodies, but live within the family system that we grew up in too. And so I think you're spot on with that.
Yeah. I just wanted to highlight how big this is and how hard it is to break through it. Anyways, I'll let you continue with what you're talking about the masculinity.
Yeah. Well, and I think even kind of highlighting what you're talking about, what are the media messages we get, right? What are the information we get from friends, right? I mean, as a boy, right, my male friends were playful with each other, but, you know, as soon as you started to cry, you started to do other things, you were, you know, belittled, you were criticized.
Annihilated, right? Like, showing emotion equals abandonment. So that is a terrifying thing.
So you learn not to, right? That's the adaptive response, right? And that's what, I mean, attachment, all these attachment styles are adaptations to our environment for the most part. There is nature to it, a degree, but for the most part, it's adaptations. And I think in terms of this, like, if you grew up in an environment where it was unsafe or you got humiliated for showing emotion, you cut off that part of yourself, right? And that's what I mean, I have clients who have said, I would rather get physically beat than to share an emotion because I believe it is so weak to share those emotions.
It's really, really big.
It's heartbreaking. And this is so in our culture, it's so ingrained that you have to, if you're going to be a guy, according to these old stereotypes, there's not space for you to be a full human being. Right. And that's what when we're talking about gender norms and stuff, I think in a lot of ways, you know, men get some parts of them cut off, women get some parts of them cut off, and we don't really become whole human beings. And when I think of, like, a wholehearted human being, I think of a secure person who is able to feel all those emotions, articulate things, describe things, ask for what they need. They feel a lot more freedom in that. But they had the privilege of being in an environment that gave them the capacity to do so. Whereas of an avoidant, they develop these defensive strategies that over time get used in their future adult intimate relationships as well.
So it's complex. So there's a development piece of it, but there's also, like, we pathologize cultural norms.
Oh yeah, individually. And I think what's interesting, here's where it gets really, really messy and really hard, right? And you're trying to give some compassion to these avoidant partners, which I love, because there is so much, like, he's emotionally available, you know, he's a horrible person, he is narcissistic, right? And to some degrees, there's truth to that, but also there's a lot more complexity to this. And so, right, what we see, right, in the research from the Love Lab and what John and Julie have kind of discovered is that when one partner has this emotional philosophy that emotions are bad, they disown those feelings in themselves. Well, guess what happens when their romantic partner is upset, has a need, is feeling unhappy with the situation in the relationship, and tries to bring that to that partner who has a tough time acknowledging and honoring those feelings? What do you think they do?
Love and accept it. They have an open conversation and live happily ever after.
Right? I wish that was the case. No, and so they take this, their philosophy of how to deal with this stuff, and they minimize their partner's needs, right? They dismiss them. They deny them. And so what we start to see is this cycle where one partner will try to bring things to the relationship to improve them. Another partner denies, dismisses, and pushes away from it. And so we start to get to in this really unhealthy cycle where whenever an issue comes up or a conflict comes up, it actually never gets repaired. It never gets resolved because I'm not going to acknowledge these feelings. It's too overwhelming for me to connect with these feelings. It's too vulnerable for me. And so when you bring them to me, I'm going to deny them. I'm going to minimize them. I'm going to push them away. We get stuck in this cycle where issues just pile up until we either go and get support to change these patterns or we end up separating.
Yeah. And then, I mean, we don't need to go into this, but what happens is often the same thing will happen in the next relationship because it's the internal pattern that's playing out.
Exactly.
So it just gets worse and worse and worse until you can actually dive into what's happening beneath the surface and heal, which is hard work.
It is hard. And one of the things that I think a lot of people, particularly avoidant styles, how the brain adapts is it creates this protective stance that inflates the self view, like, oh, I'm a good person, I'm strong, I'm independent, right? It overinflates it to withhold or almost disassociate from the neediness and anxiety that's there. And what we see is what is called defensive self-enhancement. And so they will have this idealistic image of themselves, and then when something that challenges that, they'll deny it, minimize it, and push it away. And it's really tough for them to see, wow, I've struggled at this. It's tough for them to feel that, oh man, this whole time I felt like a failure and I've really struggled to even connect with that because that was so unbearable for me.
Can you give us an example of a situation where this would play out?
So I think like a partner who, right, if one partner brings some feelings or needs to the other partner and the partner just denies them and minimizes them and does all this other stuff, right, that other partner, right, which is doing so because it also might challenge their image of them being a good partner or a good spouse. And so they're not going to face the challenges or look at it because it is at odds with that internalized image they have of themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So they're just going to be defensive instead of be vulnerable and look at the need that's being asked.
Yeah. They're not going to see, oh, my partner is hurting. It's, no, my partner is trying to attack me and something's, and they're trying to say something's wrong with me and I don't agree with that.
Oof, okay. I think we need to say that again. Instead of acknowledging that your partner is hurting, you see it as my partner is attacking me. This is huge.
Yeah. And this is where, I mean, we got to get a little bit more complex with this because sometimes partners do use criticism or contempt to express a need. Right. And that we see a lot more on the anxious style, but avoidance will tend to even take soft, gentle stuff and be like, you're attacking me. Or they often, with all the avoidance I've worked with, there's this sense of I'm failing you and I can't tolerate that. And I will withhold, I'll distance, I'll disengage because that feels safer for me than to tolerate how poorly I've failed you or how bad I've connected with you. So you kind of see like to have them face and look at what they're not doing well and that their partner is hurting is very hard for them. Did you hear that?
Yeah, we can cut that out. Yeah. Are you still good?
Yeah, my cat decided to try to climb over all the Tupperware for some reason.
So. No worries.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. You're a crazy little man.
Oh, I mean, we might want to just leave this in because it's hilarious, yeah. But we can cut it out.
Yeah, he wanted some attention.
Your cat would be the anxious style who makes...
Yeah. Give me attention. Let me be indirect about it. Yep.
Okay. So going back, I think this is a really important segue into the concept of shame and how tricky it is to work with.
Yeah. I mean, it's really tricky to work with. I mean, shame tells us that we're not enough, that we are fundamentally inadequate. And this is something that, I mean, if we go back even to how boys are raised, if you're taught that your emotions are not legitimate, you're shamed out of your difficult emotions, right? And so
say that again, if your emotions are not what?
Not validated, if they're not seen as real, if they're seen as weak, if they're invalidated, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a lot of boys, they experience that softer emotions, more vulnerable emotions, they get invalidated in these cultural dynamics. And so the way that's done is it's shame, right? If I go to a boy who's crying and I say, you're weak, I am shaming that boy for expressing emotion.
I think it can be so much more. It's so much. What's the word I'm looking for? It can be just a look, right? Oh, yeah. It could be anything. And I think the concept of shame, a lot of people don't really think or talk about it, but it's everywhere. It's a feeling of just like I'm doing something wrong or something is wrong with me. And it can be the core of a lot of our identities, especially if you're consistently invalidated. This is what's tricky with some of this kind of emotional pain that we have is like it doesn't necessarily leave a bruise. So it's difficult for us to identify. But if we experience just this mild shaming throughout our lives where we feel bad if we express ourselves, that's a big deal. And it's going to play out in your relationships and it's going to be a problem.
Absolutely. And I think with shame, I mean, this is what I navigate. I mean, and you navigate this too, right? Working with an avoidant partner, even with anxious partners, right? There is this shame of I'm not good enough. I can never do it right. And what happens is the shame, right? And I love Brene Brown's research on this, but the shame pretty much convinces us that we are all alone and there's nothing we can do to get out of that, right? And shame, it's almost like this massive dark cloud that comes over us and it's like doomsday. You can't do anything. You're stuck here. You're never going to get out of here. And it really closes off how we think or see things. And so what I'll see, particularly with avoidant partners, is they'll shut down and be like, I just fail. There's no point in me trying. What's the point? And they kind of, it's like this, I give up, right? And that's a hard place to be in. And that's often where they're experiencing so much shame that I am so broken that I can't do anything to make this better. I never get it right. I never will get it right. Do you hear that?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I don't even think people can articulate that. I think it's just a feeling of hopelessness of just like, what is the point here? And I think a lot of the time this dynamic will create something. So, you know, we could talk about, which we won't, but we could talk about like, we don't have time necessarily. We could talk about substances. We could talk about affairs. Like if you feel this feeling of hopelessness based on your own experience and your own ability to overcome your shame, and there's just no way to deal with it, we'll look at the symptom or like the problem that happens based on these core belief systems. And then that will be what we focus on instead of diving into the emotional experience of shame and how do we heal that. It's really tricky.
Yeah. And I mean, shame is, it's an overwhelming emotion, right? It's really hard to deal with. And unless you do have the language of it, unless you have shame resilience, which what Brene Brown calls is your ability to see it, but then kind of bounce out of it and engage differently, then you can make changes. And like one of those things is reaching out to other people, right? And if I experience shame about something, right, or my brain starts doing that, I have my therapist, I have my partner, I have friends that are easily accessible for me to reach out to and say, you know, for some reason I'm having a shame cloud about this, you know, can we talk about it? And then shortly after connecting with them, it's just pretty human. I get some compassion for them. I get my own self-compassion and things can get better. But a lot of people don't have that toolkit. They haven't had those experiences. And so when the shame hits, right, just like you said, there's so much hopelessness. And it just is this place of pure defeat that I think comes up emotionally. And we see that in the relationships. And that becomes really hard.
And I think what you're saying is so important. Like when we experience shame, we don't want to be seen. We don't want anybody to know. We want to hide. And so the way to heal the shame is to be open and express the vulnerability, which Brené Brown, I mean, this is her thing, right? It feels so counterintuitive to what we would want to do, which is why it's so tricky. And one of my teachers a long time ago used the terminology, like working through this stuff is often beyond our skill level. And so if we're trying to manage this on our own without somebody who's actually skilled to sit with us and understand what's happening, we just create the same cycles over and over again.
I love that. And I think that's part of where, if we're talking about this avoidance, right? If we have this compulsive self-reliance, we're going to have a tough time opening up to other people. And that's one of the things that I find, you know, from the research, we know that it is tough to even therapeutically build a bond with an avoidant person. And it takes a lot of work. And sometimes I am making some guesses to try to see what hits them emotionally. And the more I take that, the more I notice what happens in their body that they might not even notice, the more they start to get language to what is happening in their experience and they begin to articulate it. But it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to talk about, like, I really want your insight and expertise on like working with the masculine and this concept of shame and how it plays out in relationships and how hard it is to break through.
Yeah. So I think with shame, right? I mean, for masculine, you get this message, if you can't be a provider, if your partner's unhappy, if you can't sexually fulfill your partner, right? There, it means you're not a man, right? And so that's a huge shameful statement. And I think in terms of that, we look at, when I'm working with someone, we're looking at some of those core messages and how those messages get played out in the interactions. And then I tend to talk about we'll look at kind of the cultural context by which you were taught about these beliefs. And then if I'm with the partner will start to challenge that and say, no, that's not what I need here. And we start to create a new emotional experience for them. But around that, it's just, I think, acknowledging that this was the landscape, the emotional landscape that was created for you growing up. And that shame is here to kind of keep you stuck in that. And so I think around that, just being really gentle, being really slow, but it's the biggest thing around this is starting with just the awareness that you have this tendency to have so much shame about who you are. And that masculinity really, you know, masculinity, femininity, all that stuff, even racism and stuff, impacts how we see ourselves. And this is where shame wins, is shame convinces us we're the only ones that have the problem, right? And I think one of the other things that is really important when I'm working with someone with shame is I will share either personal stories, I'll share other stories of clients without identifiable information that highlights that these are pretty common experiences that people go through. And I think that's what Brené Brown says, is when we reach out, we start to realize that what we experience is a lot more common than what we think. Whereas shame convinces us that it's only us, that we're the only one that ever experiences these problems, and that we're fundamentally the problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I love the concept of we walk around comparing our insides to other people's outsides. Mm-hmm. So it just creates this dynamic of like, I'm alone, I'm different, something's wrong with me, instead of jumping into the shared experience of being a human. And that's like, it's through connection that we heal this stuff.
Bingo. And that's the beauty of it, right? Is the connection in our childhood from earlier attachment impacts us, but then we also have the opportunity to heal as adults. And I mean, even older couples who I've worked with, I mean, they're still working on kind of their core childhood wounds, but I, you know, and I praise them. You haven't given up. You're still working to heal this part. And it's beautiful to see the ways they've earned their security and they've been able to articulate the fears and anxieties and engage differently. But yeah, it's tough stuff.
So I want to talk about sex a little bit. So I want to talk about this dynamic, how it plays out. If we talk about emotions and the masculine and how that plays out sexually, can you give us some ideas around how you see that and what it looks like?
Yeah, I think this is, I mean, there's a lot that happens in here. If we go to just the some of the avoidance stuff, what we see is more sex that is self-focused rather than we-focused or partner-focused. And so sex is used as a way to get some connection, but it's not very intimate if we're in the avoidance sense. On the anxious style, we get much more, I'm going to have sex just to get closeness rather than because I actually want sex. And so when it comes to masculinity, part of how that ties into the avoidance is there's so much performance pressure, right? And there's some of your masculinity is connected with the strength of your erection or how long you last in bed, whether your partner has an orgasm, how long you have sex. It's very performance-based, not experience-based. And so it's not like, oh, this is really enjoyable or I find this pleasurable. It's, okay, did I achieve these benchmarks? Did I check these, did I mark these off my list? So I think that's part of what comes up is when we perform intimately and sexually, right? Sometimes that can become so overwhelming that we actually want to avoid that altogether. And sometimes that anxiety of that performance will lead to erection dysfunction, erectile disorder. It'll lead to premature ejaculation. And then in that, you get even more shame, right? Oh, I can't last very long, or I can't get an erection. And then we start to see cycles of avoidance around intimacy. The other thing is sometimes sexual connection won't come up because we have this fear of being intimately close with another person. And so there will be some avoidance around sexual connection because it's like, oh, this feels vulnerable, right? I'm physically naked with this person and to some degree emotionally naked as well. And because that can be intimate, if I feel uncomfortable with intimacy, I'm just going to avoid that altogether. Does that make sense?
Totally. And I think if we talk about masculinity and the ingrained experience of performance, I think it's really difficult to have performance and connection at the same time, right? You can't have both.
I don't think you can, right? And I think you're spot on. It's how can you be performing and even be connected with yourself, right? If you're focused on trying to give your partner an orgasm, you're not focusing on the sensations in your body. You're not focusing on looking at your partner's eyes and thinking, oh my God, what a beautiful person I'm getting to be intimate with, or telling the person, gosh, I love how your body feels right now, you know, and being really connected and close with them. It's all about the end goal, right? Or the touchdown per se. There's no journey. There's no exploration. There's no connection, right? And that's what sex is. I think it is this, it can be this very beautiful journey that we get to go on together. We get to experience all these wild sensations and explore and be connected intimately and talk about them and share what feels good and pleasurable and what doesn't. And unfortunately, if we're focused on the performance or the end goal, right, we're never going to have that stuff because we've been shamed into believing that's what makes us a man. But that's total bullshit. Excuse my language.
Yeah, that's good. And I think it's really important also to like talk about where we learn about sex, right? Especially with the internet and technology. And we won't go into this too much, but it's like, you know, pornography, those sorts of things are very much performance-based. It's not talking about the intimate connection. So it's this really tricky thing of what did we learn and how do we subconsciously understand what we're doing here?
Yeah. And that's the other part too, is, I mean, there's a lot of porn usage in our day, right? Especially with the technology. And a lot of people will use porn over being connected with their partner. And so we have that issue that's coming up too. And I think in terms of porn, it's not realistic, right? You get a snapshot of people who are performing. You have people doing things that other people are not open to, right? It creates a fantasy world that is not very connected to real relationships. And I think if you watch, you know, more ethically sourced porn or things that have more of a story and that are more realistic, that's going to be probably more realistic to, you know, intimacy and connection that you would want compared to this. Okay, we're going to have the plumber come over and have sex right away, right? Like those fantasies, those messages we get about that, they really disconnect us from the reality, and they can cause us to put those on our partners, put that into our relationship, and cause us to try to replay those out when maybe we actually don't want to replay that out. We just want to be more close emotionally.
I think what it goes back to is like it makes sense, but it also doesn't make sense. I think that it's really important to acknowledge that sex isn't just about sex. Like, we don't really understand fully what we're even talking about here. And it's probably so much more than that, which is why it's so tricky. And I think it's a very shameful conversation because there's this performance, people don't even want to talk about it. And I also think it's incredibly vulnerable. Like going back to what you were saying about the anxious person is looking for connection, and how that dynamic of avoidance and connection, like all of that playing out in the relationship, is super complicated, and we don't have the framework or the skills to understand it and talk about it ourselves in our relationships for most of it, right?
Right, totally. And I think there's, you know, even going back to this, we know that a lot of couples will indirectly ask for sex, right? There is shame about even talking about sex. But what we also know is that couples who talk about sex have better sex because they're able to work on that. And if you work with a sex therapist or someone around those lines, they're going to support you in being able to have those more open conversations and give you tools around that. But you're right. It is uncomfortable. I think there's a lot of secrecy and we don't talk about this. I'm not going to mention this. I'm not going to tell my partner what is pleasurable in my body. I'm just going to make sounds and hope they get that indirect cue, right? It's very vulnerable to kind of talk about this stuff. And I think culturally, there's so much shame around sex that adds to that as well.
Yeah. So I think let's end here. And this is really big stuff, and it's really important. And I would love to do more recordings, more podcasts on specific topics with you, because I think a lot of people will listen to this and it's kind of a preview to go into a lot of deeper conversations. But the core message is, we desire connection as humans, and how do we create that? And so many of us didn't learn that, and it's totally possible. So I'm curious if you can give us a little summary on like your advice on how do you have a healthy relationship? How do you feel loved? And also sharing with people how they can find you, how they can find your information.
Yeah. So I think, for finding my information, you go to kylebenson.net. There is, I think, like 170 articles on there for you to learn about connection, sex, as well as emotions and conflict. I think in terms of having kind of a roadmap for connection, intimacy, and sexuality, I think the Gottman Institute has a great website. I really like their what's called their Sound Relationship House. I think that is really helpful for learning kind of different parts of an intimate relationship. And then I really like emotionally focused therapy. So like Sue Johnson's book, like Hold Me Tight, is another lens that'll give you some ideas of attachment theory. And start to get you a better idea of your raw spots, which are your childhood wounds or enduring vulnerabilities, and ways that you can start to express those differently, which will hopefully lead to different conversations with your partner, which will hopefully lead to a different relationship, which is ultimately what a lot of us want.
Oof, and I would hope that people don't waste their time like jumping to find it externally. I just think so many people, and that's going back to the title of this podcast of Live Your Life. It's like time is so valuable. And I think so many people learn that it's external. Let me find the next thing to make me feel better. And so much of it is diving into what's happening inside of ourselves that will actually allow us to have a more fulfilling and connected life experience.
Absolutely. And I think you're really spot on there. Is sometimes we have to slow down to speed up. And I think a lot of us, you know, okay, I'm going to go try this new thing, or I'm going to try this new program, or read this new book. But I think what really needs to happen is, how do I emotionally digest this book? How do I sit in it and start to integrate it into my way of being? And for me, like, I think we can learn a lot through books, and I think we can learn a lot through those experiences. But from my personal experience in working with clients, I think the biggest and most helpful part is working with another human.
Absolutely.
And that is where they can offer feedback, and particularly working with a trained therapist, it can offer a lot of healing and insight that can invite you to try to experience things differently. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think I said this in the last podcast I recorded. I think we need other people to show us who we are. I don't think we can fully understand who we are as humans without other humans like reflecting back to us, that stuff.
I think that's spot on. I think particularly with my therapist who I've worked with for maybe 5 years now, there's definitely stuff where even now he'll poke at something. I'm like, huh, that's interesting.
Right.
It's an invitation to continue to get to know myself and be more intimate with myself too.
Yes. And I love that you talked about your therapist. And, you know, even us as trained professionals, there is not a disconnect, but it is really hard for us to connect like the conscious cognitive thought processes with the emotions. So even if you're the smartest person in the world and you write the book on psychology, there's still, you know, we still have our subconscious programming when it comes to ourselves. So I think a lot of people think that this is kind of tricky, but it's like thinking that they're like above getting help or that they can understand it, or they've been really good at pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and they're super intellectual or intelligent. We still can't see ourselves. We can't see all the parts of ourselves within ourselves. Like I have my own therapist too, and I probably will forever because, you know, my thought is like, why wouldn't I have somebody help me see myself? It's really important. And you know, the shame culture will teach us that something is wrong with us. But I think it's really important for people like you and I to talk, and especially you as a man, to say like you are working on this stuff and looking at it. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And it's actually inviting you to a better life.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think therapy has transformed my life. I mean, I've done a lot of work in addition to that. I mean, I've done coaching and other things too, but I think therapy, I mean, obviously, I'm still seeing the same person for 5 years, so something's working, right?
Totally.
And so I think, you know, like it is an invitation. I think just like you said, we need other people to see this stuff. And as you talked about, okay, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Like that is such an avoidant approach to this stuff, right? And I think with therapy, it's intimate, it's vulnerable, it's scary, and that's okay.
Yeah. And I think what you said, you know, something is working with therapy. And I think a lot of people might come into therapy with a goal of what they think that they want. And it could be our society or our culture telling you like, this is what you should be achieving. And I think a lot of the time we go into therapy and we actually get what we didn't necessarily think, or even we weren't conscious of something that existed, and that's what we get. And I think so much of that is the felt experience, the experience of our nervous system. Those are the things that we achieve in therapy. And I think that those things are often not very shiny. We're not going to get the keys to a new car, but it's going to be an experience of peace, which is, in my opinion, so much more valuable, but it's a harder sell. People don't necessarily know that that's what it is that they're looking for.
Right. And I think I love that you brought this in, right? When we look at secure attachment, it is a felt sense of security. And that's what change happens through experience. That's my belief, right? Not necessarily the insight, but through that felt sense of, I can be secure. I can reach out. I can risk expressing my needs. I can be connected and close with someone and feel safe here. Right. And I think that's what all of us crave and long for. And I think your reflection on that is absolutely beautiful and true.
Thank you. Circling back, I said we were going to end almost 10 minutes ago, but this is so good. Circling back to the expectation of time. I think, you know, therapy is not cheap and it's a lot of work and it takes time. And so I think when I talk to a lot of my clients that I work with, I set the expectation that this is potentially years long of a process, and you're probably going to spend thousands of dollars. And after each session, you may walk away not necessarily being able to pinpoint exactly what happened, but it's this secure attachment that's building in the process, and it takes time. It's an investment.
Oh yeah. And that's just it. It's a huge investment. And self-disclose a little bit. I told my therapist when I first saw him, I said, you got 6 sessions. And now it's been 5 years. So I think that I got the felt sense that I wanted that continued for me to show back up. And so I think there is this expectation, right? I had the expectation of, okay, let's go and, you know, fix 2 things and I'll be done, back on my way. But yet there's been so much richness I've gotten by kind of sitting into the work and really feeling into it. And I think it's transformed my life and it's had kind of a ripple effect in the other people that I get to work with as well.
Ooh, yeah. It sounds like you dropped from your brain into your body and something felt good enough for you to stay. Like you felt that richness and it led you to something deeper, which is so awesome.
Yeah. I'm really grateful for it.
Okay, so let's actually stop, but I will tell everybody that I'm going to put a lot of this stuff in the show notes, like the references, some of the things that Kyle talked about. And Kyle, thank you so much for the time today. And I look forward to our next podcast. And people, if you're listening to this and there's something you want us to dive into, definitely send one of us a message and to be continued. So thank you, Kyle, so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey guys, it's Jasmine. Thanks so much for listening to the Live Your Life podcast, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find the show notes and information about life coaching at jasminesavari.com. You can also find me on Instagram at jasminesavari. I am a life coach and a licensed mental health counselor, but this podcast is not a replacement for healthcare services. If you are in crisis, please call 911 or the Crisis Clinic at 1-800-273-8255. Take care and don't forget to live your life.